Lecture 6, The Beginnings of English.
Hello and welcome back. This is Lecture 6, The Beginnings of English. We've left the Indo-European peoples and we're moving now to the beginnings of the English language, the Germanic language group on the British Isles. Before we do that, we need to say a little bit about geography and culture, about history, and also linguistic change itself. In this lecture, we're going to explore the ways in which Old English emerged and to try to get a sense of exactly where Old English was spoken, how it works, and what the sound of the language is. Now, when we use a phrase like Old English, we have to be clear about what we're talking about. And here, I want to go back to some of the terms that I've developed in earlier lectures. Geography, history, genetics, and typology. Geographically, Old English is the language spoken by the Germanic settlers in the British Isles. Historically, it's the language spoken from the time of these settlements in roughly the 5th and 6th centuries AD until shortly after the Norman conquest in the middle of the 11th century. Genetically, it's a lowlands branch of the West Germanic group of languages. In other words, it's a special kind of Germanic language that emerged from the low-lying group of speakers, the area around modern-day Holland and Frisia, the lowlands, and this group moved across the channel to England. Therefore, Old English will have, as its closest modern analogs, really the languages of modern-day Holland and Frisia. Typologically, in other words, what is the actual shape and structure of Old English? It's a language with a particular sound system, with certain kinds of grammatical endings or morphology, with certain patterns of words, phrase we use is syntax or syntactic organization, and with a very special vocabulary or lexis. Now let's take some of these in order. What is the geography of Old English? The earliest inhabitants of the British Isles, as far as we can tell, after the Paleolithic peoples who built such magnificent structures as Stonehenge, were Celts. They were members of a Celtic-speaking group that moved from the continent to the British Isles. These Celts were displaced in two moves. First, by the Latin-speaking Romans, who in the age of Caesar and well into the middle of the 5th century inhabited or colonized the British Isles. Latin became the prestige language. Celt and Roman intermarried. Many towns bore Roman names. And yet, there are still some bits and pieces of Celtic in English. A great example is the word Avon. Someone once asked me, why are there three River Avons in England? And I said, it's because Avon is the Celtic word for river. So you have a situation where there are still a few Celtic words surviving in the language. In about the middle of the 5th century, a group of Germanic tribes starts to move in to the British Isles, conquering or settling, depending on your point of view. And by the year 547, a kingdom was established in England, north of the Humber River, by groups descended from the Angles, which was a continental group, and they called themselves the Anglians. Angles and Saxons and Jutes were the primary tribes that moved, and we call the Germanic-speaking peoples of the British Isles Anglo-Saxons, to represent that original group of tribes or Germanic-speaking peoples from the continent. By the middle of the 7th century AD, small kingdoms were being established throughout England. Some of these were little more than outposts or even villages, and others were areas with great power and wealth. But what starts to emerge in the 8th century in England is a recognition that these people are no longer just Germanic-speaking people someplace else. There is the beginning of the recognition that these people are English. In order to understand that sense of Englishness, we need to do several things. And it is at this point that I want to introduce the idea of dialect. I've talked a little bit about regional variation in earlier lectures. Now I want to get specific about regional dialects. Throughout the history of English in the British Isles, dialect boundaries have been important. They are usually natural boundaries, but occasionally some major man-made boundaries that distinguish groups of speakers and also inhibit passage back and forth among those groups. Old English, to a large degree like Middle English, and to some degree like Modern English, had four major dialects. And it's worth pausing just briefly to look at them, because they'll have a role in the literary and the intellectual life of the Anglo-Saxon peoples. Now, you can see these dialect boundaries on any modern map of the British Isles. North of the Humber River was Northumbria, and this was the area where the northern speakers of Old English lived. In the middle of the country, between the Humber River on the north and the Thames to the south, was a great central area which in the Anglo-Saxon period came to be known as Mercia. In the area of Kent, south and east of the Thames, was a dialect known as Kentish, and just to the west of Kent in the south of England was the area known as Wessex, where the West Saxon dialect developed and flourished. Now, why are these dialects important? I think they're important for several reasons. First, because they correspond to some important historical moments in the history of Old English. Northumbria is the first area of what we might call an efflorescence of Anglo-Saxon culture. Figures such as Bede the Venerable, the historian, ecclesiast, and grammarian of Northumbria, wrote many works of instruction and history, his most famous being the Ecclesiastical History of the English Church and Peoples. And he epitomizes the flowering of Northumbrian culture at the end of the 7th and the beginning of the 8th centuries. The Northumbrian dialect is quite distinctive. And our earliest piece of Old English poetry, the hymn attributed to the poet Cædmon, is in, originally, the Northumbrian dialect. Mercian and Kentish have several literary and cultural documents, but it is really the language of the West Saxons that's important for us. And it's important for many reasons. First, West Saxon, the dialect of the area known as Wessex, was the language of King Alfred, who unified the group of Anglo-Saxons and in effect became the first English king. King Alfred did many things, not the least of which was the establishment of an intellectual community around him, a group of scholars, translators, and perhaps, some have argued, even poets, whom he effectively commissioned to translate the major works of classical and Christian antiquity into Old English. They translated them into the West Saxon dialect. By doing so, King Alfred, in effect, established West Saxon as the literary or prestige dialect of Old English. Now, this is very important because it has some major consequences for Old English and also for us. in terms of Old English, what Alfred and his successors do, in effect, is create a literary standard out of a regional dialect. This is a very important phenomenon. We're going to see this again and again in the history of English, whether it's the London dialect of Chaucer or the received pronunciation of the 17th and 18th century in southern England, or in America, the language of New England or the Northeast, or what we think of today as the Midwestern dialect or Midwestern form of English. That is, how does a regional variant of a language become, in effect, a national standard? But there's also another scholarly consequence to this that's very important. For by doing so, what King Alfred did, and what his successors did as well, was they encouraged any later reader to take any piece of Old English, regardless of its dialect, and translate it or rewrite it into the West Saxon dialect. So that, for example, Cadman's Hymn, which is in Northumbrian, we're going to read it in our next lecture. You will hear it as I read it to you in the West Saxon dialect. Scholars of the 19th and 20th century, people who wrote textbooks, very often took texts and rewrote them into the West Saxon dialect, even if there was no manuscript tradition to suggest that the text had ever been written in the West Saxon dialect. Imagine the works of Mark Twain rewritten in the language of Boston. Imagine the great regionalists of America recast into the idiom of Franklin Roosevelt. And you have something, I think, analogous to what I'm talking about. The great impact of a regional dialect standard here. Now, one of the things that's also fascinating about Old English, and one of the things that we'll only have a chance to look at, but it's a seed that I want to plant in your minds, is not just how it flourished, but how it died. During the 11th century, new teachers and scholars set up schools in England to teach students not just in English, but in Latin. And this establishment signals another major theme for us in this course, and that is what the relationship is between the vernacular and the educated. To learn to read and write in English is different from learning to read and write in Latin. Anglo-Saxon England is perhaps the first place in Europe where students read and wrote in their own vernacular. It may very well be unique for its time in that students were considered literate if they read and wrote in their English. This is a terribly important concept for a world that measured literacy as Latin literacy. The history of the English language is many things. Now, it's the history of literacy in Europe. And the idea of learning to read and write in English is something that is born and then dies with the Anglo-Saxons, with the Norman conquest, with the rise of French, and the restoration of Latin as prestige languages throughout the Middle Ages, English effectively disappears as a primary language of instruction for 400 or 500 years. King Alfred and his successors, and then in the 10th and 11th centuries, the later bishops such as Aelfrich and Wulfstan, who establish schools in England, establish schools that teach both Latin and the vernacular. Now, what is this Old English that I'm talking about? How can I describe it to you? I've given you some hints in the lectures on Indo-European. For example, I've given you a hint that it's a language with strong and weak verbs, with verbs that signal their changes in tense by the meaningful change in a root vowel, drink, drank, drunk. Weak verbs which signal change of tense by adding a suffix, walk, walked. This is interesting not just because we see the survival of strong verbs in our own language, but what we see is, in effect, the disappearance of strong verbs as new verbs. Words that are coined today, any verb that is coined today, is coined as a weak verb. Today, we televise. Yesterday, we televised. It's not today we televise and yesterday we televose. Also, old strong verbs have tended to become weak verbs. Wax, meaning to grow. The moon waxes. Yesterday it waxed. But in Old English and in Middle English, this is a strong verb. Wax, wax, you waxen. It's still the same in German. Grow, grown. But it, now it's waxed, wax, waxed. Help, helped, a weak verb. But as late as Chaucer, as we will see in Chaucer's English, help, hopen, can still be a strong verb. Shine, shined, but shine shone. Hang hanged, hang hung. How do we use these? Sometimes it's ambiguous. Sometimes we may use these words to signal different relationships. For example, I shined my shoes, but the sun shone. I hung the picture, but the man was hanged. New restrictive uses of words that are still strong and weak. Many people who study the history of language like to comment on the fact that there are pockets of archaic language in America and England. And every now and then, the famous example is trotted out of Dizzy Dean calling a memorable baseball game in which, excited by the play, he yells out in a beautiful, untranslated form of his own regional dialect, "He slud," and I believe it's "he slud into third." Now, many people who hear this think that Dizzy Dean was illiterate or that this is a regional variation. It's an old, strong verb. Phrases like clum that we sometimes see or hear in regional language. These are strong verbs. They're archaisms, in effect. They're bits and pieces of an older, if not an old English. So I'm calling attention to this because you still hear it today. Now, what's distinctive about Old English, and what's distinctive about many of the terms and phrases that we're going to encounter, are not just these verbs, but the nouns of Old English. Old English is a language rich with nominalizations, with words for things. The Anglo-Saxons, it would appear to us, loved to coin words, loved to make new nouns, often in very poetic and evocative ways. Poetic nouns are called kennings. They're little noun metaphors, things like Hronrad, the whale road for the sea, or Swanrad, the swan road, also for the sea. These nouns are part and parcel of a larger lexical resource that not only described the world of experience, but translated the classics from Latin into a palpable vernacular. Of course, it almost goes without saying at this point in our course that Old English as a highly inflected language had grammatical gender and its nouns. Nouns were masculine and feminine and neuter. And as in many modern languages, it is important not to confuse grammatical gender with natural gender. A word like wief, which is cognate with our word wife, which means a woman, or perhaps more particularly a wife, is a neuter noun. But all concept nouns in Old English, any noun ending in the suffix ness, is a feminine noun. Witherward nessa, distress. Old English signaled the plurals of its nouns, often with an S. But there were many kinds of nouns that descended from older Germanic forms where the plurals were signaled differently. And I pause to review some of them because we still see them today. Why do we say man, men, foot, feet, mouse, mice, goose, geese? We say this because in the branch of the Germanic languages from which Old English came, there was a sound change that went on when certain words had certain kinds of suffixes. And in the early Germanic forms, in perhaps the most primitive of the Germanic languages that have been reconstructed, one would have said, man, manes, fot, fotis. Man, mans, fot, foots. It's that E's ending, that I-Z ending, that somehow changed that root vowel. And Old English shares with some of the Germanic languages this special kind of change. Once the root vowel changed, the old ending dropped off, was redundant. Now, this is an important feature of the language. It makes it distinctive, and we see it today. Child, children. But again, as with strong verbs, history creates ambiguities. When do you say brother, brothers, and when do you say brother, brethren? The word brethren is of a highly restricted use now because it sounds archaic, even though it was the old plural. In Old English, the plural for book was not books, but bitch. One book, two bitch. This takes us back to Indo-European. The beech words. The cognates for the beech tree words in the Germanic languages are the book words. Some people have argued that this is because beech or birch bark is somehow associated with an early writing technology. And that what is encoded in our word book and that old plural beech, which is lost to us, is again another fossil of something, of an early way of writing and reading, of an association between the intellectual world and the physical world of experience. Now, when we look at Old English vocabulary too, we have to look at the way in which the Germanic languages developed their own words and borrowed new words into the language. As I will be developing in the next lecture, we see several periods of borrowing in the history of the Germanic languages. When the Germanic-speaking peoples came in contact with the Romans, they learned many of the Roman terms for the things the Romans made. It's a commonplace to say all roads lead to Rome. I think the reason why all roads lead to Rome is that the Romans built all the roads. The Romans were the great road builders, and the Roman word for road, strata, becomes the word for street in almost every language that had contact with the Romans. There are many, many languages with words for street, but they're not cognates in the Indo-European sense. They're all borrowings from the Romans. Words for war, or words for the wine trade, words for certain kinds of economic engagements are words borrowed from the Romans. Many of these words were borrowed before the Anglo-Saxon peoples split off from the Germanic group. And we call these continental borrowings because they're borrowings that occurred on the continent. Words that are borrowed once the Anglo-Saxons got to the British Isles are insular borrowings because they're borrowings on the islands. Now, how can we use a little bit of philology to distinguish them? I'm going in my next lecture to give you several lists of these, but what I'd like to do now is show you a little bit of a trick. And that is, how can we do linguistic history, cultural history, through sound changes? You remember foot, feet, man, men. This was a sound change that happened at a very special time in the history of the Germanic peoples. It probably happened in the 2nd or the 3rd century AD. And it only happened to one branch of the Germanic languages, because there are some surviving Germanic languages in which this does not appear. As this sound was taking, the sound change was taking place, it was taking place not only on native or original Old English words, but it was taking place on words that had been borrowed. For example, take a word like money. Money comes from the old Latin word monita. Now, when you have a word monita or monetarium, which is a place where you make money, you've got that same little I. That same little I changes your vowel before it. Goose, geese. Man, men. Money, monita, monetarium, is transformed in this sound change into a place where money is made. A mint. A monk lives in a monastery. But when that word enters the Germanic languages, before that sound change happens, the monastery becomes a minster. And of course, my favorite one, the Latin word for the unit 1/12 of something is unicius. And that becomes our word inch. Now, this is a little, think of it as a little trick. When did a word enter a language? Did the word go through a certain sound change that we know that happened? And after it went through the sound change, did it change? That's how we trace the entry of the terms. That's how we distinguish certain kinds of words. And as we, as it were, inch our way through Old English, we can see how the loan words from Latin get absorbed into the native Germanic and Old English vocabulary. Now, where I'm going to begin in my next lecture is really with this sense of native and borrowed vocabulary terms. And in particular, in the way in which Old English vocabulary creates a literary landscape out of the older Christian, Latin, and inherited spiritual worlds of the church. In particular, I'm going to focus on the first known poet of English, Cædmon, who wrote a great hymn to creation, probably in the last third of the 7th century AD. And in this poem, we will see how Cædmon uses the resources of his own language to translate old terms. You'll remember the term calc that I used. Cædmon's is a language full of calcs. Old English is in many ways a language that resists borrowing words in favor of coining new words. This is a feature of many Germanic languages, and I think the best way of illustrating this is for me to close with an anecdote. When I was studying Old English and when I was studying philology, I spent some time in Iceland because I was studying Old Norse. And my Old Norse teacher told me that modern spoken Icelandic was just like Old Norse because the Icelanders were small, regionally constrained, and archaic, at least linguistically archaic, civilization. And that, to some degree, my knowledge of Old Norse, the language of the Vikings, the language of the sagas, the language of the Eddas, would be just fine when I got to Iceland. Well, of course, I got to Iceland speaking Old Norse, and nobody knew what I was saying. And I realized that, of course, the Vikings didn't have planes, and the Vikings didn't have jeeps, and the Vikings didn't have the kinds of things that are part and parcel of the modern vocabulary. But what I also realized was that, like Old English, like Old Norse, modern Icelandic was a culture of calcs. There were very few loan words, but lots of native words made up anew. And this told me something very, very powerful about the Old English language and the Germanic languages in general. And as I lived in Iceland in the summer, I worked on a farm, I discovered the way in which all these calcs worked. And one day, working on the farm, when I couldn't express myself, the mother of the farm family told me I was mother sick. And I thought she meant I was mother sick, that I was homesick. And I ran to my Icelandic English dictionary, and I saw that mother sick was not homesick or mother sick, but it was a calc. It was a translation of a learned word from the psychological vocabulary based on Greek. It was a translation of hysterical. And what is hysterical? But hysterical, its root, hystero, utero. Its root is in the uterus, the idea of hysteria as a distinctively female phenomenon, that mother sick was in fact not homesick, but hysterical. I was, at that point, not just homesick, but hysterical for the history of the English language. And I think what we'll see in our next lecture is the way in which the calques and claims and coinages of Cadman give us a world limned through the native and the imported, the spiritual and the topographical, to give shape to English poetry for the very first time. Thank you.